Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Welcome to Teachings in the Air. Welcome to Teachings in the Air podcast with Jerry Oldman. Coming to you from Hunkaminam territory with a podcast series about Indigenous men's health and wellness. We aim to inspire, motivate, and empower Indigenous men to be sound in mind, body, and spirit, because that's what health means.
Hello, this is Teachings in the Air with Jerry Oldman. Today's podcast is called Jerry's Road to Reconciliation, or saying hello to my problems so I can say goodbye to them. You know, it took me a while to figure out this podcast. You know, what's going on in the world, in social media, we can see it, we can hear it, we can feel it. And at times, I wonder, what's the truth? You know, so I wanted to do this to, I guess, to solidify my understanding of what Jerry's to do. What am I to do? You know, I grew up in an inclusive home. A home where there was good food, laughter, support, encouragement. You know, we're all part of it. Help with cutting wood, packing water, feeding the chickens, you know. Oh, it was good. Safe. Never hungry. Warm. Oh, that was good. Just thinking about it, I smile and give thanksgiving to my family. So that's my world as a child, as a small child, you know, between 1 and 5 years old. That was my life. Didn't know anything else. So all I knew was that if I was hungry, I'd have food. You know, if I got hurt, someone would help me. So I grew up like that, and it wasn't until I went to school that I all of a sudden didn't feel included. You know, that system of education, of putting knowledge into Jerry, and if he makes a mistake, strike him. Oh my gosh, that shocked me, because I hadn't experienced that before. If I made a mistake before, they would help me correct it. Not in school. Oh, it got so that I was afraid to do anything. Because if I make a mistake, I might get hit or humiliated, something thrown at me. You know, and I think of those times that, you know, that relationship with education started off in a harmful way for Jerry. You see, and I think about it now, right now, there never was a relationship with those teachers. Because reconciliation is about repairing relationships, restoring friendly relationships. And not one bit of friendliness for me in that system. And I think about it now, that's pretty shocking. So that's how I started not to feel included in that school. You can see that I was in these little pods or these little spaces. First off, there's a home, which was good. Then I go to the school, and I meet other children. But the atmosphere wasn't there for us to, I guess you could say, form relationships. It was a rigid structure. Lineups. We had playground. There was some fun in there. But always there's that, for me, that fear of making a mistake. And it wasn't, you know, and I started to go through that system, and it was the same right to, I guess you could say, grade 10. And even into 11 and 12, because in grade 10, that's when I integrated. Going to school with white teenagers. Oh, that was a culture shock, because up until then, all my classmates were indigenous. In my community, we were all Stetliam. No, we didn't speak the language or do ceremony or ritual at school. You know, we just... And I remember we'd sing O Canada, God Save the Queen. You know, stuff. And then that integration, you know, it was, then I could really see the difference. You know, it seemed to me that everybody would talk at once or weren't afraid to. Whereas we were, I guess you could say, taught respect for others by listening to them, not interrupting. But now, in this system, I remember my friend and I were, I think our first day in school, in high school, off the residential school grounds in the town of Kamloops. The bell rang and we went out because we have to change classrooms. And we're standing against the wall and all these students were around us, milling around. And to me, everybody seemed to be talking at once. I remember saying to my friend, "Who's listening?" And he says, "I don't know." You know, so there was a culture shock there. It was totally different. So it was after I left, I graduated, and I left the school system. Then I went to work. I went to work in a logging camp on a railroad, and then I went home. Oh, I worked as a painter in Vancouver, a house painter. And then I'm just running away those times from my memories by drinking and doing drugs. It was after I left the city and went back to the res. That's when I started to learn about what happened about the Indian reservation. I went out with my dad, and he showed me this peg in the ground, white peg, with numbers on it. And the word, letters IR, Indian Reserve, number one. He says that they surveyed and put these pegs in to show what was Indian Reservation. This became our boundary. And I see in that drawing lines on the map is it become almost like a prison. It's told we couldn't hunt beyond those boundaries and fish before. We had to get a permit. It's going, oh. I could see the poverty in my community, the unemployment. And I started, of course, to ask. I became involved in the community by becoming part of the council. And it was there that I started to be politicized. I guess that would be the word, politicized, or starting to understand what happened. I hear the words land title. The words of BC is Indian land. You know, and I heard these wonderful orators talking about rights. And I remember the first time I heard the declaration of the Lulwit tribe. It was a declaration that went on May the 10th, 1911, by our leadership of our communities, 11 communities, Statliam communities. They made a declaration. I imagine they must have had an ally help them do the words, but the feelings in it were there, and I remember reading it. And I'll read you part of it, because this started to form Jerry. We, the underwritten chiefs of the Lulwit tribe, declare as follows. We speak the truth, and we speak for the whole tribe, numbering about 1,400 people at the present time. You can see that smallpox had taken its toll. We claim that we are the rightful owners of our tribal territory and everything pertaining thereto. We have always lived in our country. At no time have we ever deserted it or left it to others. We have retained it from the invasion of other tribes at the cost of our blood. Our ancestors were in possession of our country centuries before the whites ever came. It is the same as yesterday when the latter came, and like the day before when the first fur trader came. We are aware the BC government claims our country, like all other Indian territories in BC. But we deny their right to it. We never gave it or sold it to them. They certainly never got the title to the country from us, neither by agreement nor conquest, and none other than us could have any right to give them title. In early days, we considered white chiefs like a superior race that never lied nor stole, and always acted wisely and honorably. We expected they would lay claim to what belonged to them, selves only. In these considerations, we have been mistaken, and gradually have learnt how cunning, cruel, and untruthful, and thieving some of them can be. We have felt keenly the stealing of our lands by the BC government, but we could never learn how to get redress. We felt helpless and dejected, but lately we begin to hope. We think that perhaps, after all, we may get rid from the greater white chiefs away in the King's country or in Ottawa. It seemed to us all white chiefs and governments were against us, but now we commence to think we may get a measure of justice. And I read that, and the leaders of my people at the time followed that, talked about that. So that was my background on this whole idea of nationhood or my people. And I started to feel proud of my people. That we'd never given up. That feeling of belonging to the land. You know, it was a real struggle for us as 11 communities to work together in this regard. Because of the tactics of those governments, they followed the way of divide and conquer. It was very efficient, very effective. So all of a sudden, you know, not all of a sudden, but gradually, you know, over the years, people started to, individuals started to make noise about harm. You know, we had people going to jail for hunting and fishing, for not allowing their children, or saying, no, you're not going to take my children to residential school, potlatching. You know, we were going through that. It happened to us. And we're recovering from those events. We were objects of spiritual and cultural conquest so that people could get to the resources, other people than us. It was we didn't know about this hunger, this love of power that these newcomers had, that they were motivated by individual personal wealth to have this power of being richer than others. We didn't know that. Or my people didn't know that, I should say. So 1995, even before that, there were people all of a sudden saying, hey, I was hurt at a residential school. And a whole movement started. First off, criminal charges against people, against individuals that abused children in a residential school. That started. Then in 1995, there started to be civil civil court action about personal pain and suffering that individuals are going through because of what happened at a residential school. And I started to support survivors that were going to court. One of the first things I learned, I remember, was even how this come to be, that there's these court cases. The first step was to prove liability. And I was told by a lawyer that there'd be no cases if there's no liability. And that means that the government and the churches that were running the residential schools became liable because they knew that there was harm being done in the residential school and did nothing to stop it. So they became liable in the court of law of this country. Oh, I remember the numbers. Gee, one day there's 5,000 warriors, wounded warriors that said I was abused at the residential school. Jumped to 12,000. Oh, people were coming forward, taking on the government and the churches, one by one. I heard heartbreaking stories, history from survivors going through the civil court process. Because in the civil court, they were trying to find out how much they were liable for. So they would ask questions about before residential school, during residential school, and after residential school. That was a long process. Expensive, costly for the governments. I remember one of the churches saying, we're going to be financially bankrupted by these court cases. I remember I was angry. I said, well, you have a choice to be financially bankrupt or morally bankrupt. I remember telling these church people, I know that if Jesus came down today, he would tell you to make it right. That's when I said you could be financially or morally bankrupt. You know, the civil court was going on. Then all of a sudden there was a class action lawsuit accepted in the courts. And the class action lawsuit was about loss of culture and loss of family. And the class action that was accepted in the courts of Canada included the children of survivors because of the intergenerational impacts. The government of the day settled out of court. And I think about it, they were protecting their taxpayers, because one of the lawyers I was talking to was saying, if this class action goes through and is successful, it's going to cost the government billions of dollars. Because there was cultural genocide. The families were, you know, fractured and harmed. Is causing a lot of pain and suffering. So they settled out of court. And out of court settlement. And it included common experience payment where Oh, the part that got me very angry was the out-of-court settlement was only between the residential school survivors and the Government of Canada. They excluded the children. And I observed, because I'd been working in it for years and heard this, the history, that the children were hurt. Because the trauma that their parents or grandparents had gone through had never been treated. And there was intergenerational impacts. I was upset. But that promise of money for survivors, it was going to go through. Common experience payment became reality. Then there was commemoration. There was a fund set aside for commemoration to communities could, you know, put up a memorial about the residential school experience. Then there was a Healing Foundation. Turned out not to be a foundation because it ran out of money. Foundations generally go on and on and on and on. Then, of course, there was a TRC, Truth Telling and Reconciliation Commission was to be established. So the TRC was between First Nations and Canada to restore friendly relationships, to restore mutual respect. As the truth part was, it was formed to reveal past wrongdoings that happened in the residential school in the hope of resolving conflict. You know, they had principles. The TRC, we had brilliant people being part of the commission. It went through its two, but they came up with their report. But their part of their principles was, number one, restore what must be restored. Repair what must be repaired. Return what must be returned. And that's where I started to have my doubts. How do you restore a language? Of course, you put resources into it. You find ways to help people restore that lost language, or a language that's severely damaged, stolen. How do you repair broken families or broken individuals? By providing relevant healing for them. Return what must be returned. Oh, I thought about our tiny little reservation. Because Canada is the second largest landmass country in the world. Number two in the whole wide world. Other countries are small, like England. You think of England, how small it is, that island. And lots of resources in Canada. So how do you return what's been taken? What? You know, that really, you know, I don't consider myself a greedy person. But I would compare and contrast when I'd leave a reservation and I go to town or Vancouver or Kamloops or other cities. And I see what they have for their children and playgrounds, rec centers, swimming pools, tennis courts, all of those things. And I think about my poor community. If they returned